This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here in the U.S., a federal holiday typically means a day off and a good excuse to eat and drink and shop. As years pass, the original motivation to commemorate a person or an event fades, and historical details get eclipsed by our personal memories and snapshots of holidays past. How does a federal holiday become a thing anyway? And why haven't more recent events, like September 11th, been reflected in the federal holiday calendar? Joining us to discuss the history and heritage of the 11 federal holidays currently on the books are two of the three hosts from the popular podcast Backstory with the American History Guys. Peter Onuf is Senior Research Fellow at Monticello, and he's the 18th century guy. Peter, welcome.
Hey, Virginia.
And Brian Ballow is a history professor at the University of Virginia. He is known as the 20th century guy. Brian, glad to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Well, Brian, I'm going to start with you. The most recent federal holiday added to the calendar celebrates the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. What is the path that it took to become a holiday from advocacy to day off?
Virginia, it was a long and winding path. Shortly after Dr. King was assassinated in 1968, there were calls to celebrate his life and his contributions by making his birthday a national holiday. But in fact, that did not become the case until 1983 is when the legislation was passed.
And not even all states.
Yeah, 15 years. Well, all states, and we're not going to talk insurance here. We're going to talk federalism. And all states don't have to celebrate federal holidays. That's the rub. You know, even the definition of federal holiday is somewhat complicated. All it really means is that federal employees get the day off and get paid for it. It doesn't mean the states have to go along.
But, Brian, it's worth pointing out that a lot of federal holidays simply ratify days that were celebrated in the states. So that the state set the tone, and then the
there you
the
go again, Peter.
Yes,
there you go again. Such an 18th century guy. It's all states all the time for
That's
Peter. But
right.
I got to admit, he's absolutely right there.
Well, based on what has happened in the past, what are the chances that September 11th, for example, would someday have its own federal holiday?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of pushback to that, as you know, Virginia, and some of it we dare not actually say out loud, but I'll risk it, and that is there's a lot of money involved. Mm. Every holiday costs the federal government, what is it, $400 million?
$450
yeah. like
is the
that. Yeah. So there's some talk about trading days. How about I'll give you one Labor Day and you give me one Patriots Day or whatever they're going to call it. Well, that's tough. And that's another reason I'd throw out. And that is you got two back-to-back weeks with holidays if you made September 11th a federal holiday.
Right, because you've got Labor Day right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, couldn't the argument be made that a lot of money gets spent on those holidays, on traveling, on food, certainly on alcohol?
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. And for once, I'm going to argue that it's not all about money. I think one of the problems with making 9/11 a national holiday is we tend not to celebrate tragedies. We celebrate the successful peace after tragic wars, as the case with Memorial and Veterans Day. But think about Pearl Harbor, right? We do have, we remember Pearl Harbor. It is formally a day of remembrance. And by the way, 9/11 is, too. It's a day of remembrance and service, and it's even been given a name by Congress. It's called Patriot Day, not to be confused with Patriots Day,
in
by
Massachusetts.
The way. But we tend not to celebrate tragedies, and there is much, much to be grateful for in the response to 9/11. Don't
right. That's interesting, Brian, about celebrating tragedy, which sounds a little bit oxymoronic in the first place. And I think that raises the issue of what we do on holidays, which is, of course, they've become institutionalized in our yearly calendar as, well, vacation time, celebration time, party time.
I buy mattresses, Peter.
And I'd just like to point out something from a deep historical perspective, and that is we do Thanksgiving, and that's a holiday that goes back to the very beginning, but we don't do fast days. Now, a fast day would be the sort of thing, you know, we all deny ourselves for an entire day. Then you'll get into the tragedy. What a tragedy a fast day would be.
You know, the fast days, aren't those generally religious holidays anyway? And let's consider how many of our federal holidays are stemmed in religious holidays.
Well, all I'm suggesting, Virginia, is that there were fast days early on in American history, of course, throughout the colonial period. And they'd come during wartime. Mm-hmm. And they would be moments of reflection and solemn contemplation. And the early Congresses had the occasional during the Revolution. There were fast days, days of remembrance. And we don't do that. And I think that's a major consideration.
Virginia, I told you Peter is a contrarian. We all worry about taking religion out of holidays like Christmas. Peter wants to put religion back into holidays that don't even exist.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, listen, I'll tell you the real problem with lots of holidays, and I'm not saying anything about 9/11 because I think this is an important day, and that is they were largely banished from the Elizabethan calendar in England because saints' days, when they were 100 saints' days during the year, would be days of revelry. And it was very hard to get anything done if people were always drunk. Our complaints about about Mondays, those long weekends, well, they used to talk about Saint Monday. Even if there wasn't a holiday, you'd take Monday off because you'd be partying all weekend. So I think that's to give a long historical perspective on this. And I think that's the deepest concern about 9/11 is, do we want to have a day that institutionalizes a break, a vacation, a celebration?
And it has to fall on an actual day, unlike, you know, the sort of Monday following 4th of July. Are there any other new holidays that are currently being suggested or seriously considered by lawmakers?
Oh, sure. There's always holidays in the hopper, as they say. There are those pushing for Cesar Chavez Day, the very effective labor organizer, agricultural labor. There are people pushing, as you know, Virginia, there are people pushing for making every even year, the first Tuesday in November, making it a holiday when we have federal elections, congressional and then presidential every 4 years.
As it is in many other countries, right?
Yeah, I think those are the two most likely candidates. Did I miss something, Peter?
Do we really want to celebrate Election Day, though, given the recent results?
Some people want more people to vote. Other people say, less people will vote. They'll all take a holiday then. They won't even bother.
I'm talking to two of the history guys anyway. Peter Onuf, the 18th century guy, is with us, and Brian Ballow, the 20th century guy. We're talking about the inception of federal holidays. Peter, I'm wondering if you could play the part of the 19th century guy for a moment. And what was the very first federal holiday, and why was it created? It happened in the 19th century.
Yeah. Well, there's Thanksgiving itself was not officially established until 1863 by President Lincoln. The great spate of holiday establishment was in the late 19th century, and that was with what we now call Memorial Day. When did Columbus Day come along anyway?
I believe
that's a real 20th century question, Peter.
Pick it up for us.
That wasn't until 1968, and it was part of a combo package.
Oh, right.
That's when they moved all those, let's call them lesser holidays, to Mondays, right? And so we moved Memorial Day and Veterans Day to Monday, and we also got Columbus Day.
Well, talk to me about Columbus Day, because somebody has to be behind pushing these holidays forward. And I came to understand in some light reading that FDR was heavily lobbied to make it a holiday by the Knights of Columbus. Tell me about the process of something going from idea to, you know, what kicks it over, what crosses over and pulls off a holiday?
Well, I think that you put your finger on one very important facet. That's lobbying. But usually people have to lobby for a long time. You know, you think about FDR being lobbied by the Knights of Columbus back during the New Deal in the 30s and the 40s. Well, we don't get it till 1968. A lot of African-American organizations lobbied for 15 years for Martin Luther King Day, as did others. And first they submitted 3 million signatures. That's a lot of people to sign a petition, pre-internet, by the way. And that didn't do it. So they came back with 6 million signatures. That almost did it. But you know who put them over the top, perhaps, is Stevie Wonder, who wrote a song called Happy Birthday.
Wow.
Very popular song. But he was talking about MLK in that song. So multimedia, grassroots lobbying, lobbying inside the halls of Stevie Wonder. It's not every day that Stevie Wonder signs up for your cause.
Well, so, Brian, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Columbus Day began with in the Roosevelt period, and it finally was established in 68. Could you get a Columbus Day through now? I mean, it seems to me the most vulnerable of the holidays.
It is. Not only could you not get it through now, I think you couldn't get it through now. It is in danger of slipping away.
It may be rescinded. There have been a number of people or organizations that have advocated for it to be replaced.
Let's face it. And if this angers you, send your email to Peter Onuf. Even the town of Columbus, Ohio, hasn't held their Columbus Day parade for a while. So, yeah, I'd say it's in a little trouble.
Yeah.
Do holidays matter as much as they used to?
Well, it's a heavy question. They matter to us, don't they? And to your listeners. I think there's a lot of mixed feelings about all holidays, of what the point is and whether they do focus our civic consciousness on important moments in our collective history. And I think that's the other side. I mean, we celebrate. We like to have occasions to get together and to affirm our American identity. But then what is that identity and what are we doing? And is this some kind of civil religion that we're practicing? And should we institutionalize it in this way? I think even Thanksgiving would be vulnerable now if you introduce this as a new holiday. I think there's a lot to be said for maintaining the old ways and the traditions. We are historians, after all, and let's maybe let all these sleeping holidays sleep and not mess with them. That's what I say.
How about for you, Brian?
Yeah, I would say they do matter in the middle. They do matter in the midterm. Those who are arguing for a holiday on 9/11 to take them seriously are primarily lobbying because they don't want people to forget. Mm-hmm. And for those of us who were well into adulthood when the planes hit, we're never going to forget. But for kids in elementary school today, they don't know what 9/11 is. They don't know what it's about. And so the best case for holidays is that they focus attention. And in fact, if they recur every year at the national level, given the kind of media saturation we have, you can count on thoughtful people like Peter talking about the history of such holidays at a minimum. They do help us remember. However, I think they have a limited shelf life. You measure it in decades, not in days or weeks. But after a while, they do become something that triggers mattress sales.
Brian and Peter, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Onuf, Senior Research Fellow at Monticello and Professor Emeritus at the University of Virginia. He's author of many books, including The Mind of Thomas Jefferson. Brian Ballow is Professor of History at UVA. His most recent book is A Government Out of Sight: The Mystery of National Authority on 19th Century America. They represent two of the three American history guys from the popular podcast and radio show Backstory. You'll find a link to the podcast at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, when it comes to remembering historic events, maybe you do just have to be there. Stay with us for a memorable visit to Gettysburg. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The federal holiday Memorial Day honors all Americans who have died while in the service to the military. It was originally known as Decoration Day and was enacted after the Civil War to commemorate the fallen soldiers on both sides of the battle. One historic battle was at Gettysburg in July of 1863 and lasted 3 days, claiming the lives of more than 50,000 Union and Confederate soldiers. A staggering number. And those troops take on a sepia-toned past. But consider this. The last surviving Civil War veteran died in 1956, less than 60 years ago. Nate DeMeo of the Memory Palace brings us a story of Civil War veterans returning to Gettysburg in 1913, 50 years after the three-day battle.
There was no major television documentary time to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the Civil War, which is an obvious point. But indulge me for a minute. The men who fought, those who were still alive in the 19-teens, hadn't spent the 5 decades since the war seeing the same images and newsreel footage rolled out again and again, the way that veterans of later wars have. They had no flag being raised over Iwo Jima, or a nurse being kissed in Times Square. They hadn't seen that same loop of film, the one shot from the back of the plane that shows the bombs raining down over the Vietnamese countryside, the one that's in full color and always in slow motion, usually with the Rolling Stones or the Doors playing in the background. The images they had, the memories they still held, whichever ones infused their dreams, the ones that were summoned by the sight of a tintype in a frame or a flag folded up in a drawer, the images that would be triggered by a walk near woods that looked a lot like the ones they once ran through, rifle in hand, hoping like hell they wouldn't die that day. In the summer of 1913, more than 50,000 old men traveled to Gettysburg for a 5-day event commemorating the 50th anniversary of the 3-day battle. They posed for a lot of photographs. And in them you can see the men standing in fields, atop hills, leaning against fences. And you can imagine the conversations they had as they pointed out the physical landmarks that had anchored their visual memories for the past 5 decades. And you can imagine the men in their mid-70s and their early 80s reminiscing about shared moments, each man conjuring up his own set of images that, if properly recalled, would echo the next man's. And I don't know. It must have been nice. To be nearing the end of your life and to spend a few days with so many people who shared, or very nearly shared, the same pictures and loops that had been in your head for half a century. Now, we're almost done here. But I wanted to remember one particular veteran before I let you go. Thaddeus Sobieski Constantine Lowe was 80 years old at the beginning of 1913. He wouldn't live to see the summer of the Gettysburg reunion. He died in late January in his daughter's house in Pasadena, California. But if in his last days he ever found himself in a veteran's home or some other place where old soldiers sat and reminisced, he couldn't have found anyone who shared the memories of the things he saw during the war. Because there wasn't a man alive who saw those things. He could have counted the men who ever did on his fingers. There was John Wise, John LaMountain, Ezra Allen and his brother James, a few assistants, and that was it. And they were all dead. Which left Professor T.S.C. Lowe as the last man to have seen the Civil War from above. He was an aeronaut. He was a balloonist. He spent the 1850s doing what all balloonists did in the 1850s. He tried to come up with ways to fly across the Atlantic. But when war came in 1861, he offered himself and his balloons to his government. His job was to fly hundreds of feet in the air and look down. He soared over battlefields until he crash-landed behind enemy lines at Bull Run. After that, he just went up and down, rising above army camps, taking off from the middle of Chesapeake Bay, turning a coal barge into the first aircraft carrier. He would signal down to Union forces about enemy positions and troop movements. But he would also do that thing that we, 150 years later, have all experienced and have long since stopped being impressed by. That thing where you're in a plane taking off, or at the window of a tall building like the Space Needle, or whatever it is they call the Sears Tower these days. That thing where you look down and people look like ants, and the buildings look like tiny boxes, and the mundane becomes marvelous abstraction. And there's that moment when the thought runs through your head that those people down there in those boxes, they're not just small. They're small. And aren't we all when you really think about it? And then you reach a cloud bank and open up the Sky Mall and forget about it. T.S.C. Lowe got to do that over the Civil War, and I can't imagine he ever forgot about it. We can imagine what he saw and imagine what sorts of images he held until his death 50 years later. But we can't know how it felt to see those things. To have men down below dying and retreating and killing and risking death to save others and lying in fields hoping someone would come to them before they bled out. And to have altitude render those men as patterns in movement. To watch lines rush forward on green fields and collide and atomize as the soldiers who made up those lines fell and fled and vanished beneath smoke and fire. And to look out beyond the Virginia battlefields to the border, the line that separated two nations, and caused the men below him to fight and to die. Lowe could look out to the place where that line was supposed to be and see that there was nothing there at all.
And that story came to us from Nate DeMeo in the Memory Palace. You can find it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. We're going to take a look at America's well-intentioned but sometimes misguided impulse to commemorate. That's after the news from NHPR.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When the 9/11 Memorial Museum opened in May, there was more fury over its gift shop than its design. Museum administration claimed that the shop would generate revenue to support an estimated $65 million in annual operating costs. Still, families of those killed and others found it crass and insensitive. Among the keepsakes that raised eyebrows and ire, an FDNY rescue dog vest for your pup, survivor tree earrings, a cheese plate in the shape of the United States, and one item called a darkness hoodie. As offensive as it is to some, the impulse to memorialize, and perhaps profit, has been part of the fabric of American culture since the Revolution. Brady Carlson, host of All Things Considered on NHPR, joined me shortly after the opening of the 9/11 Museum to discuss our historical impulse to commemorate. I asked him when, in American history, we first saw people using tragedy as an opportunity to hawk their wares.
As far back as there's been tragedy and as far back as there's been wares, honestly, I mean, you think of funerary art, art representing death or remembrance. I mean, that goes back into ancient times. And it's not really a huge stretch, I suppose, for someone to decide that they could make a few dollars by selling their funerary art. In early America, there was a very popular series of products based on a picture called The Apotheosis of Washington. It's basically showing George Washington after death being welcomed into heaven by a group of angels. And you'd find this on prints and on water jugs and all over the place, not to mention black ribbons or memorial medals and coins. I mean, the list goes on and on. And it's really kind of stayed that way ever since.
Other funerary trinkets of American presidents come to mind?
Probably my favorite is one that I saw at the tomb of James A. Garfield, who was our 20th president and the second one to be assassinated. This wasn't really a memorial item. It was put out, I think, in the 1920s or 30s, but it was by a company called the Garfield Tea Company of Brooklyn. He's from Ohio. But it was a laxative tea. So they have this incredibly disturbing slogan called "Flush Your Bowels with Garfield Tea." And what exactly this was intended to do, I'm not entirely sure, but it was probably one of those cases where here's a very well-known figure. Here's a chance to sell some products. We put the two together and off we go.
Location, location, location. Well, even at the site of the World Trade Center, while the buildings were still smoldering, people were selling American flags and Statue of Liberty hats, and people were taking photos of themselves with buildings in the background. What is behind this impulse to be in that place, to acknowledge that you were there?
I think that's really what it is. We like souvenirs, frankly, and so we like to have something that we can hold in our hands or something that we can display at home to remind us of a particular experience that we had, whether it was being part of a major news event, good or bad, or something that has personal resonance, or simply something that we experienced, like going through a museum. That's why they all have gift shops, because people do buy things. They like to have something that they can take with them. And there's a term that I heard in particular with the 9/11 Museum. I read it in Maclean's, and the writer Ann Kingston called it catharsis consumerism, that buying things is one of the primary ways that we commemorate major events. And there's a cultural component to it as well. And you think of what happened in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombings. The Boston Strong T-shirts were initially put together as a way to raise money for the one fund, right, for the victims. But on top of that, it became a way for this group of people, the city or the community of the greater Boston area, to sort of cope with this horrific event, and also a way that people could participate and take part in.
It's a common cause.
A common cause, exactly.
Yeah. Well, all right, let's look at Gettysburg. 50,000 people killed. Yet it's like this living museum. There are people wandering around there with costumes and loads of items in the gift shop that one might find questionable. What are some of the things that are on offer?
Well, I mean, it's worth pointing out that Gettysburg, by the way, is, aside from the official gift shop and the official battlefield itself, is this sprawling tourism place, not even just in the actual Gettysburg area. Just driving in or out on either direction, you'll find tourism-related stuff everywhere. Nothing attracts an entrepreneur like a crowd, I guess. But you will find everything from a Robert E. Lee nutcracker. What is it, $200, I think?
$200 for that. But we should note that the regular troop member waving a flag is $109, and the colored troop member, $99.99.
Well, rank has its privileges, among other things. But there are Civil War officer costumes for kids. I remember seeing play money, lots of historical toys, the kinds of things that 19th century kids might have played with. And then there are T-shirts with slogans of all manner of tastes, like no rifles, no swords, just balls. it really is a case of, when you get that many people coming, and thousands of people come to Gettysburg every year, you get people who are coming for a lot of different reasons. Some are very interested in the history, and they're very emotionally connected to the people and the events of those days. And then you have other people who sort of vaguely remember the name Gettysburg and think it's kind of cool to have been in some place where something important happened, and why not do a little shopping while you're there?
How about the World War II Museum now? Let's put this in perspective compared to Gettysburg. Battle deaths, 15 million. Civilian deaths, 45 million. A long time in the making. What can you buy there to commemorate this historic event?
Well, you could play World War II Monopoly. You could have all manner of military vehicles take the place of the thimble or the dog or the wheelbarrow. There's a D-Day lighter gift set. There are GI helmets for kids. I've seen museums where you can buy military-style rations of every kind. And good eating, right?
And lucky strikes.
Exactly.
Well, the Monopoly game, I just want to read a little bit of the description. Honor, courage, victory. Honor the brave men and women who face the global spread of tyranny when you play America's We're All in This Together, a World War II edition of America's favorite game, Monopoly. So, you know, I guess a part of it, the tackiness may come in the merchandising and, in this case, the copywriting.
And sometimes the intent can be different from the outcome. I mean, I always grew up thinking G.I. Joe dolls were kind of a crass cash-in on very honorable people serving the country. And yet, we heard this week when the creator of G.I. Joe dolls passed away, you heard his story, and he said, this is a way that we can bring into popular culture a way to remember that there are people in the world who are trying to protect us every day, that they are serving and willing to risk their lives to do that. And that kind of turned my head around about that. I had no idea that that was the actual impetus behind G.I. Joe.
I'm joined by NHPR's Brady Carlson, and we're talking about the controversy surrounding the gift shop at the 9/11 Memorial Museum in New York City. It turns out that tone-deaf keepsakes have been a part of American history for a long time. But I guess the other decider here is when is it too soon? Not a lot of time has passed since September 11th, 13 years. It's still vivid in the memory of many people, unlike Gettysburg or Pearl Harbor, for example.
And I would bet that that changes what you would see in a gift shop. Had there been a Gettysburg gift shop 10 years after the battle in 1873, you wouldn't have found some of those nutcrackers or the playing cards or the Abraham Lincoln Growler Kids Buzzsaw that you might find in some of these shops in the Gettysburg area today.
Let me just mention how freaked out we were about the buzzsaw. I mean, what did they use the buzzsaw for in the Civil War? It's just not a good picture. But, you know, okay, yeah, Gettysburg does feel like ancient history to us. But, of course, kids who weren't born on September 11th or were grade school kids are going to be finding out about what happened there in a very, very different way. I guess this is the churn of history in the same way that I look at stuff at the World War II Museum and find, you know, Hawaiian shirts with bombers on them to be of questionable taste.
And I think that the people who have emotional connections to these events are going to look at them differently than people who were born afterwards and are having a much more intellectual conversation about it. There is an argument being made, and it's always made, that really what you're doing, yes, you're buying a trinket, but you are in a way supporting this museum and you are supporting an effort to try and tell the story of this museum, and you can go back and forth on that. But what you likely will find is that the museums will end up with more revenue with a gift shop selling some of these questionable items.
And then people clearly buy them.
And people, well, we'll see about the cheese plate, but these items would not end up on the shelves if people didn't buy them.
It's not just the passage of time, but of course it's how we communicate. This is something you and I have spoken about a lot. The Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum, now this was commemorating the most similar event to 9/11 in recent history because it was an attack on U.S. soil. One article that I read, there were no cries of anguish when the Oklahoma City Museum's gift shop opened. But it was also noted that this was pre-internet and social media days. So maybe people just weren't weighing in?
That's a really interesting question, because if you walk through a gift shop, you're walking through kind of as yourself. You're not necessarily broadcasting to the world that you find the fact that they have one particular trinket or other to be offensive or in poor taste. Whereas now you can, and if one person happens to have their opinion catch fire and several tens of thousands of other people start to have the same reaction and say, wait a minute, I don't think that's okay, then you might have a much bigger question, a much bigger debate on your hands. For what it's worth, the items that I saw on the online shop for the Oklahoma City Memorial were pretty low key. There were no cheese plates that I could find.
There was the one rescue dog.
There was the little rescue dog plush toy, which outside of the context is absolutely adorable.
Well, lest I sound like I'm completely against this, when I went to the Holocaust Museum in Berlin, it was such a moving experience that I picked up something. You know, it was a postcard, but it was just a photograph of something or somebody that I wanted to remember. So I don't by any means want to come off as, you know, boy, this is a tacky, horrible thing to do. Gift shops are just a part of the thing. But is this a particularly American thing, do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, we certainly do tend to lead the way on these kinds of trinkets. This is a society that prides itself on its entrepreneurial spirit and participation. Then again, there are, as you said, there are gift shops at the Anne Frank House. There are gift shops at Holocaust museums all over the world. There are gift shops at the Hiroshima Monument in Japan. So there's just something very human, boundaries aside, about finding a way physically and maybe virtually going forward of saying, I was here, this meant something to me, and I want a way to keep that tangible as I go forward and go on with the rest of my life.
Well, Memorial Day was this past weekend, and many people, you know, head to the beach or the barbecue, long weekend. And there's a lot of criticism about that we're forgetting the essential meaning of Memorial Day. Do you think that will eventually be the same with 9/11?
It's certainly possible. I mean, you've seen, I think what you've seen is that at least in this first generation, when those of us who remember it very vividly are still here and still part of that debate about the meaning of the day and how it should be commemorated, the core memory of the day is still there. But you're already starting to see it evolve here, even in this first generation, with people who are still around and still remember it very vividly. You see the National Day of Service, and you start to see, you see these debates about, well, in an election year, is it appropriate for candidates to campaign on September the 11th, or is it not? And that debate is going to continue going forward. But with Memorial Day, what you've seen is the core meaning is still there, but there are these other meanings that have been hung on there as well. And a lot of that is due to the economic impulse that's always part of culture. Tourism organizations who say, this is really a perfect way to kick off summer. It's an event that we're all familiar with. It's an event that we all in some way participate in. And so we will, whether or not they intend to take away from that actual meaning of Memorial Day or not, it adds this other layer of meaning on top. And so the day tends to evolve rather than completely change in one direction or another.
Conversation there with Brady Carlson from May. That was shortly after the opening of the September 11th Memorial Museum. Brady is host of All Things Considered on NHPR. We've compiled a slideshow of some of the most tone-deaf historical keepsakes. You'll find that on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Since its opening 3 years ago, the 9/11 Memorial site has had more than 11 million visitors. Up next, we're going to consider this. In a world of virtual wonders, is it still meaningful to stand in the actual physical spot where history, no matter the circumstance, was made? We'll explore that when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Since its opening just 4 months ago, nearly 1 million people have visited the 9/11 Memorial Museum. More than 14 million have visited the memorial site since it opened to the public 3 years ago. So in a world in which radio reporters, TV correspondents, and digital adventures can take us virtually anywhere, why are so many driven to pay their respects on the actual site of the attacks? Just a week before the memorial opened, WNYC's Sarah Fischko examined the impact of traveling beyond your desktop to stand on the spot where something happened.
In a world of virtual wonders, is it still important to stand in the actual physical spot where history, for good or ill, was made? To visit places of tragedy, memorials, and historic sites?
Permit me to tell you what you would have seen and heard had you been with me on Thursday. It will not be pleasant listening.
We've been able to visit so many places over generations without necessarily ever going there.
As we approached it, we saw about 100 men in civilian clothes with rifles.
Edward R. Murrow told us on radio in 1945 what he saw at Buchenwald, what we might have seen at a concentration camp.
I was told that this building had once stabled 80 horses. There were 1,200 men in it.
Later, Walter Cronkite went to Vietnam to report on the Tet Offensive, to see it for himself.
We're in an observation point overlooking a house some mile and a quarter across the hills there where it is believed...
And came back with a different view of the war. He changed a lot of minds.
You know, but they're waiting for air power to give them a little assist. And the weather has been frightful here for 3 weeks.
In those earlier days of media, it was shocking but oddly satisfying to turn on a box and have these places in the world brought into our living rooms. We trusted and admired those correspondents and trench coats.
From tonight. I want to show you a little bit, though, of where I am right now. I'm very close to the water's edge.
More recently, Anderson Cooper, no trench coat, took us to New Orleans after Katrina. He was less of a mediator for us, not so much a distanced reporter on the scene.
There are just trees, huge, enormous, age-old trees, which have just been tossed up like twigs.
He was a person with unusual access and a privileged platform, and he famously brought anger and frustration along with him and gave us even more of a sense of having been there ourselves.
For the last 4 days, I've been seeing dead bodies in the streets here in Mississippi, and to listen to politicians thanking each other and complimenting each other.
Without any correspondent at all, we can even put the whole World Trade Center history in our ears through the Sonic Memorial Soundwalk.
Nearly all the sound and stories you'll hear in the next hour were recorded at the World Trade Center and in the surrounding neighborhood over the last 100 years. Stop at the corner and you will see Ground Zero on your right.
So even now, when it's so easy not to bother, why do we still want to be in that spot?
Standing in the same site seems to transport us back to the moment somehow.
Even James E. Young, who was on the jury that selected the Michael Arad, Peter Walker design for the World Trade Center Memorial, was jolted by the feel of the site downtown. The jury had chosen the memorial design from drawings and models, and they agreed on its merits in meetings, sitting around tables. And then they went to the site itself.
What we didn't understand until we actually visited these memorial voids was the overwhelming scale of the site. And suddenly, we were swallowed up into it. We actually stood at the bottom of the voids looking up. And suddenly, we as people felt very small.
Young has visited memorial sites and monuments all over the world. He's observed that memorials sometimes become stand-ins for the events being remembered.
Part of the experience, you know, in standing in the space is that something in us does get changed. We are changed inwardly by the experience of standing in the memorial space. And in some ways, I guess that becomes a version of being changed inwardly by the event itself.
Certainly for an NYU student, Johanna Mayer, who was taped just after the Osama bin Laden raid, there was no place else on earth that day she would rather have been.
I'm from Missouri, and so it felt like it was almost in a different country. You know, I knew no one here. I also watched videos on YouTube, but it's something that I felt like I needed to learn more about, and that can't happen on YouTube. I mean, we're here. And, like, I've never been here before. I've watched here on YouTube and on the news, but I've never been here.
Our culture wants you to get over tragedy quite quickly. You know, you get maybe a year to get over somebody's death, and then everyone thinks you should be moving on.
Ruth Sergel is an artist and activist. Soon after September 11th, she gave people who'd been on or near the site that day the chance to relate their experiences on video with no rules, no time limit, in a project called Voices of 9/11. She believes in taking your time.
I think it's the communal experience that's the most important part. There's something absolutely critical about being with other people who are also having a similar experience. And I don't know if it matters if it's the exact site or not. I think that probably adds to it. But I think the more critical thing is just that there's other people there.
You know, the accessibility of the virtual world may in fact intensify the need to actually be in a place and have a real experience as opposed to a virtual one.
For Clifford Channon, the 9/11 Memorial Museum's education director, part of the human experience is being there.
See, the reason you know the deep meaning of a place like Ground Zero is the automatic associations that come to mind when you mention it. So you speak about the World Trade Center, and then for Americans, the first thing you're going to hear about is Pearl Harbor. Or you're going to hear about a little deeper into Gettysburg and Antietam. I mean, these connections suggest themselves very, very naturally. And so you understand instinctively that if this is what 9/11 evokes, then it's now part of a chain that is a chain of witness. It's historical, it's identity, it's national. It's a chain of witness that somehow needs to be connected in a physical way to the real place where there are these links in the chain. You know, on that day 10 years ago, another link in the chain was forged. And so the need to bear witness, to pay tribute, to do a pilgrimage, to associate yourself with this history, I don't think it can be done only in virtual terms.
Those things, it seems, are what will draw untold numbers of visitors to downtown New York. The scale, the camaraderie, the link in the chain. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fishko.
From telling stories of the day to visiting memorial sites, many people have come up with rituals for remembering September 11th. This morning, I was following former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer's tweets. It's a moment-by-moment account of where he was, traveling with President George W. Bush. And for the past few years, I've been remembering the day by watching Man on Wire. We're listening to the soundtrack now. An enthralling documentary that plays like a heist movie. It's about the fulfillment of French acrobat Philippe Petit's dream to walk a tightrope between the Twin Towers, which he did for 45 minutes on an August day in 1974. Amazed New Yorkers stared up at the tiny figure balancing in the void of what were then new towers, a spectacle in the New York sky that would be unmatched for many, many years. Man on Wire is on Netflix InstaPlay now. I can't recommend it highly enough. Thanks so much for joining us today to remember to move forward. We'll be back on Sunday at noon right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.